Okay, today I want to go into another thing from Maury Terry's book, Ultimate Evil. This is an interesting one, but before we jump into it, I do want to say that this is not, when I talk about books, I'm not just going to talk about true crime. This is just a really big book, so I got several ideas from it. I think we'll do one more episode on this book before we move on to something else. And then from moving forward, I'm going to try to jump between books more often so that we're not sitting in one subject for too long. Just feel like I needed to say that. Also, one other thing I feel like I need to say, if you're wondering whether you should post video on X, let me just tell you this. The last video I posted, which was Digital Disaster, which is usually about like my nerdier details, my most niche topics, almost 700 views. The podcast version, I think we're about 30. So if that doesn't tell you a little something, I just wanted to throw that out there because I don't see enough people posting on here, and I think you might be missing out. So just keep that in mind. Okay. So once again, we're going into Maury Terry's book, Ultimate Evil. Generally, what happens with these so far, when we're, now that we're talking about ideas from the book as opposed to the book as a whole, there's usually one thing that surprises me or just I can't get out of my head. Sometimes it's as little as one sentence in a book, and I stew on it, and I stew on it, and I write notes about it, and then I try putting it on index cards, and I kind of, in a minor way, I start to obsess about it a little bit, and because of that attention, it grows and grows. Now, I'm hoping we can do shorter episodes where they don't grow as big as this one, but this one grew kind of big. Considering that it started with, what is that, three short sentences, which I might as well just read right now. So there's a, near the end of the book, Maury Terry is interviewing a guy who calls himself Brother John. And Brother John is a former, according to him, a former member of this devil cult in New York that supposedly David Berkowitz and the Carr brothers also belonged to. This is, for those who haven't read the book, don't know anything, this is where the theory of the whole book, that there were multiple Sons of Sam, not just one Son of Sam killer, that it was a group of people, this is where it comes out of. That he was part of this devil cult, and these other people were also involved in the crime, and then that's why, when you look at the sketches of the suspects, none of them look like each other, because they were different people. That's the general theory. So this is the thing that Brother John said. I wasn't even reading this. I was listening to his audiobook. I remember exactly where I was standing when I heard this because I was listening. I heard this part. I kept walking and then I stopped. I said, wait a minute. Skip back, skip back, skip back. Listen again. Whoa, that's weird. And that's where it all started from. So the quote from Brother John is, it was about 1967. Me and another young guy were told to dig them up. Bodies. He's referring to bodies here. We were told to dig them up. They were wrapped, but from the weight, I'm pretty sure they were kids. Correction. They were wrapped, but from the weight, I'm sure they were kids. I added the word pretty there. They were wrapped. Those three words. Actually, it wasn't even three sentences. They were wrapped. Those three words started this whole thing. The reason the words "they were wrapped" in reference to these bodies stuck out to me is because of something that I mentioned in the previous episode in passing. Joshua Zeman wrote the introduction to Ultimate Evil, which basically was what I spun off of for the last episode. And one of the things that he made was a show called Killing Season. And Killing Season was a show that the series that they did, I think it was six episodes, they did for A&E. And I can't remember his production partner's name. I'm sorry. I can't remember her name right now. It's not in my brain today. But they produced this show, and the first episode started with the Long Island serial case. In particular, the case of Shannon Gilbert, which we'll talk a little bit about in a second. if you want to know more about this case, because I'm not really going to break into this case much, I'm just pulling out little details. There's an excellent podcast series called Long Island Serial Killer, or LISK. And I, of course, I would also suggest you watch Killing Season, which I already recommended before. Those would be good starting places for you to kind of dive into this if you're into it. Also, Robert Kolker wrote a book called Lost Girls. I think it's Lost Girls, which was made into a Netflix movie. And actually, it might have been multiple. No, I think it was a movie. Sorry. Watching too much content. Sometimes you can't remember if it was like one movie or if it's something they broke up into multiple episodes. Anyways, when we go into something like LISK, there's just too many details that I can cover here. So you just have to, we'll just have to hope that I give you enough details for the people who don't know what I'm talking about to be able to pull together this idea. And my notes here are kind of all over the place. And I kind of left them that way because I feel like if I structure them too much, I come in these episodes and I'm just reading. And I don't want to do that. I want to actually be talking through this. That's the whole point of doing this. If I'm just going to read it, I might as well write it. You know, if we're going to do video, I might as well talk through it. So going back to They Were Wrapped, this reminded me of the Long Island serial killer case, which I may refer to as LISK as we go through, which is just the abbreviation. In the Long Island serial killer case, there were 10 bodies, I believe, that are associated with that case. Some of those bodies, I don't remember the exact number, were found wrapped in burlap. That's why this stuck out to me. Why? Because number one, this cult was in New York. Long Island serial killer case is in New York, wrapped. Now, of course, we're talking 1967. To about 1997. So some of the LISK crimes are from before that. Some are a little bit after that. So about 30 years apart, but still a strange detail. These bodies that were found were wrapped in burlap. And there was an assumption here that all of these bodies that were found, these 10 bodies, were from the same killer because they were dumped near Gilgo Beach or along that tract of beach. Recently, this as recent as this summer, someone was arrested in conjunction with this case. His name is Rex Huerman. He has not been put on trial yet, so as of yet, he's innocent until proven guilty. But he is being put on trial for 3 of the 10. I believe that the law enforcement is under the opinion that he's at least responsible for 4 of them. I think they just don't have enough evidence of the 4th one. Those 4 were kind of all grouped together. And as far as I remember, once again, I'm going off my head here. As far as I remember, those 4 were the ones that were not wrapped in burlap. So it's possible that Rex Huerman is responsible for those 4 and is not responsible for the other ones. It's also possible that he's responsible for all of them, which I think people in law enforcement would be happy if he was responsible to all of them because, you know, the person who was doing these awful murders of sex workers would theoretically be behind bars, if assuming he is found guilty. And I know it sounds crazy, maybe if you don't listen to a lot of true crime, or maybe even if you do, the idea that 2 killers could be active in the same place at the same time sounds a little strange, right? This is one of the theories that you will see if you watch the Killing Season. One of the things that Zeman and his partner do is they kind of get involved with the web sleuth community. And when getting involved with the web sleuth community, they end up on the phone with this guy who says he's a profiler. And one of the things that he says at looking at the way the bodies are found and the locations and so forth is he thinks it's possible that there were 2 killers active at the same time. And when the second one started dumping bodies, the first one became territorial because Some of the dumpings, it's so weird to talk about human beings and use the word dumping, but some of the dumpings were starting to become haphazard. And one of the theories that maybe he was doing this so that things would be found more easily, so that, you know, territory. This is my territory. This is my, it's like a gang war almost. Sounds a little crazy, but bear with me here, because the idea of two serial killers being active at the same time in the same place is not that crazy. In fact, the idea of two serial killers being active at the same time in Long Island is something we already know to be true. From 1989 to 1993, Joel Rifkin was killed 9 women on Long Island. From 91 to 96, Robert Shulman murdered 5 women on Long Island. It's 2. Robert Angelo, a former nurse, murdered at least 4 patients in 1987 on Long Island. John Bitroff, convicted of killing a sex worker in 1993 and a second one in 1994 on Long Island. Alan Gormley, convicted of killing 2 prostitutes in 1990 on Long Island. And now Rex Huerman on trial for 3 of the 10 list cases, 3 of the 4 referred to as the Gilgo 4. That leaves 7 bodies. But that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 killers active between, we'll say, 1987 and today, but mostly concentrated in the 90s. Almost all of them overlap, all killing at the same time, at the same place. So now, is it so much of a stretch that there's another one? I don't think so. In fact, we know there's another one. Actually, I shouldn't say that. There's a possibility of another one. We have the Manorville Butcher. This is someone who still has not been caught. Manorville is on Long Island. Now, there's some people believe that the Manorville Butcher is John Bitroff, that he's responsible for these bodies, that they just haven't been able to connect him to them because he was a carpenter who lived on Long Island in Manorville. But we don't know. So it's possible. It's still possible. So if you can take into account the possibility that there is someone else responsible for some of the Lisk bodies that is not Rex Huerman, the fact that in 1967, this Brother John guy claims that he dug up bodies. Let's go back to that. So he said that he removed bodies from a wooded area across the street from a doctor's house near Untermeyer Park. Now, Untermeyer Park, if I remember correctly, is Yonkers, which is not on Long Island. But the doctor across whose house this wooded area was from had a summer residence in Long Island. And when David Berkowitz was arrested, this doctor's summer residence, the phone number for this doctor's summer residence, a doctor who, for all we know, should have no connection to someone like David Berkowitz. David Berkowitz had this guy's summer residence phone number on his possession or in his possessions. Now, when reading the book, there's talk about phone numbers that were found on him when he was arrested. And then at a later point, they talk about phone numbers that were in his possession. I don't know if those are the same phone numbers or if he had phone numbers on him when he was arrested. And then when they went through his possessions, like his apartment and so forth, they found more phone numbers. Don't know. I don't have clarification on that. So bear with me on the wording when I talk about that. The reason that this is interesting is not only because it's another connection to Long Island and it connects this 1967 possible story, because for second of all, we don't even know if Brother John is telling the truth. You know, we don't know who this person is. But at first I was interested because it was just New York, but then when I found it was Long Island, that was very interesting. But then something strange happened later in the book where I was walking and they talked about these phone numbers that Berkowitz had on him when he was arrested. The phone numbers that were on David Berkowitz when he was arrested, here's some of them. This is not all of them, but here's some of them. He had the number for a Montauk golf and racket club. He had two summer residences of doctors, one of which we might have just mentioned. He had the number for a private residence in East Hampton. He had an unlisted number in East Babylon. And he had an exclusive home, a number for an exclusive home on Shelter Island. Okay. I started to, in my head, I'm not familiar with New York, being from California and now living in Texas. I've never even been to New York. I've not been to Long Island. So I don't understand the geography. But I do seem, when I was listening to this, I did seem to remember something about Montauk being at the end of an island. That it's, you know, when I think of Montauk, the first thing I think of is Eternal Sunshine of a Spotless Mind. Meet me in Montauk. Taking the train out to Montauk. And in my head, I'm imagining the train going out, and I'm remembering that when they get to Montauk, it's a beach. And so I pulled out my phone and I looked up map to see Montauk. And yes, Montauk is on an island. It is at the end of an island. And that island is called Long Island. So Montauk is on Long Island. Well, it's just kind of, it was just another moment where I'm like, what the heck? So I started, I listened to that section about these phone numbers. Not only were the residences of these, did he have the residences, summer residences of doctors, but those residences were on Long Island. East Hampton is on Long Island. East Babylon is on Long Island. Shelter Island is on Long Island. So he had phone number for Montauk Golf and Racquet Club on Long Island. He had the phone numbers for two Long Island summer residences of doctors. He had a phone number for a private residence in East Hampton, Long Island. He had an unlisted number for East Babylon, Long Island. He had a number for an exclusive home on Shelter Island on Long Island. What is going on with Long Island? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, minimum of 6 killers on Long Island. Then we go back to the 60s. 70s, which is when this book was published, 1977. And David Berkowitz is talking about this group and this group being responsible for the Son of Sam killings, that he didn't do it alone. And he's got in his possession these phone numbers of rich and powerful people. And then when you go into Brother John's story and some other people, they use the name Vincent. These aren't their real names, but these are people that Maury Terry interviewed, and they talk about this powerful group on Long Island that at the time was one of these devil cults. But then Brother John says that he didn't actually think that the leaders of this group believed this, quote, Satan crap, but they believe people can be led and used. It started to make me think that this group, if they existed, was just glomming onto what was kind of the zeitgeist in the moment. You had these groups rising up, these cult group rising up. Remember I said that the cult movement was huge in the 60s. So if you're this powerful group and you want to control people, you maybe would jump onto this whole devil thing. And then maybe over time, if you stick around, you've slowly filtered that out. So if that's possible, I want to go back to the list case here. Now that we're thinking if that's possible, I want to go back to Shannon Gilbert. I said that Shannon Gilbert was the first, well, she wasn't the first victim found, but she was the first, maybe first is the wrong way to say it, because of Shannon Gilbert, because of what happened to Shannon Gilbert is the reason that the bodies involved in the list case were found. Shannon Gilbert was a sex worker. I'm going to go through this very fast. I'm going to miss a ton of details. She went to a job on Gilgo Beach on Long Island with her driver. She goes into this dude's house, Joe Brewer, and she parties with him. They leave for a few minutes. Nobody knows where they went, but assuming they went to go get drugs, but it's a really far drive to the city. So the only assumption there is if they did that, they would have had to go get it from somebody else in the neighborhood. Anyways, they go back to the house, they're partying, and then something happens. Shannon starts flipping out. She calls 911 while she's in. Now remember, she's a sex worker on the job doing drugs, most likely. We don't have 100% of that. Most likely doing drugs. And she calls 911. So either something was going on or she lost her mind. One of the two, right? You know, maybe the drugs caused a psychotic break of some sort. This is one of the theories. The guy calls the driver who sits outside and tells him, you got to get this guy's driver's name is Michael Pack. You got to get this girl out of here. He goes in there and she's like hiding behind the couch and he can tell that she's on the phone with 911 and she's saying, they're trying to kill me. They are trying to kill me. As far as Michael Pack knows, there's nobody there other than Joe Brewer. She ends up kind of running out of this house. She runs over this guy, Gus Coletti's house. He calls the police as well, calls 911. Now the police are actually on their way. The reason they weren't on their way from Shannon's phone call is because she's calling from a cell phone and she can't tell them. She's not coherent enough to tell them where she is. She doesn't really know where she is or she can't explain it. So they can't really dispatch anybody. They don't know where to dispatch them. But when Gus Coletti calls, now they know. She goes and knocks on this other woman's door. The woman doesn't answer the door because I think it's at this point, 2 or 3 in the morning. And there's a woman outside of her door, like banging frantically on her door. So the woman gets freaked out. She calls 911. Michael Pack in this time has lost track of Shannon because like she ran off. He went to get in the car to go find her. He can't see her because this is not exactly a place with sidewalks and streetlights. This is a small beach community. So he's lost her. He's looking for her. He can't find her. He knows that she was on the phone with 911. He knows that she's been knocking on these doors. So eventually he's like, I gotta go. So he calls her phone and leaves a message to tell her that he's left or whatever. And then Shannon's gone. No one sees her. So her family is looking for her. So I think somehow they get in contact with her boyfriend and maybe he gets in contact with Michael Pack. I don't remember the details. Eventually, you know, nobody sees her. Eventually there's this police officer with a dog, a drug sniffing dog. I think it's a body sniffing dog of some sort. He's out there training this dog on Long Island and he happens to find a body and completely unrelated. And he happens to find a body. And everybody's like, oh, they must have found Shannon Gilbert. No, they didn't. It wasn't Shannon Gilbert. It was the first Lisk body that they found. And then they found more. And then eventually over time, they found Shannon. Now, Shannon's case is still kind of up in the air as to whether she was killed or whether she died of exposure from being out there. There's a lot of evidence pointing towards that, but then there's some question about her hyoid bone, which is missing, probably because of animal predation. Animal probably ran off with it. gross detail, I know. But that bone, if that bone is broken, that suggests that somebody was strangled. So they can't really tell. And because they don't find her body for a long time, there's no toxicology. There's, you know, there's nothing that can really be done. You can't even look at the body to see. Basically, at this point, they're looking at bones to see if there's injury. There's no way of telling from the meat of the body whether there's an injury. So theoretically, Shannon could be a victim of murder. Theoretically as well, she could be a victim of Lisk. But that seems pretty unlikely because the Lisk, whether it's one or two people, they took bodies and put them somewhere else. They didn't kill people and leave them where they killed them. So the reason I bring this up as well is because one of the theories, going back to this profile, we're talking about these multiple killers, there was another theory about that came up during the Shannon Gilbert case and also has been applied when looking at the rest of the Lisk case, and that is that there have been rumors for a long time of a powerful group of men who live in Long Island who have wild sex parties and wild drug parties and often employ sex workers. And as far as we know, all of the victims of the supposed Long Island serial killers are sex workers. So if Rex Huerman is responsible for four of those, is it possible that some of, if not all of the others, are the victims of this group of powerful men? Seems like a crazy theory. We hear theories about the cabal, right? This cabal. What if it's not that crazy? There's a movie, it's a fictional movie. It's not a documentary. It's a fictional movie called, I believe it's called Revenge. I should have looked it up before I started, but it's made by BJ Novak, and it's about Texas. It takes place in Texas. He plays a guy who wants to be a podcaster, comes to Texas because this girl that he hooked up with once had, she had died. She had died. And his family was under the impression that he was her boyfriend. And somehow he ends up going out there, even though he really doesn't know this girl. And part of it is because he wants to be a podcaster. So he thinks maybe I and go out there and make fun of them Texas folk and make a podcast, become successful because he's kind of a failure. Anyways, the idea of sex parties, sex drug parties, where somebody accidentally ODs and gets drug and left is something that comes up in that movie. So is it so much of a stretch to think that this group, maybe they've been operating for 30, 40, maybe at this point, if they're still around, 50 years, changing, growing members, but having to continually have parties, and then every once in a while, something happens, you know? Sometimes a girl ODs, sometimes a guy loses it and hurts a girl. Who knows? And maybe they wrap them in burlap. I don't know. But I do think it's very strange that there's a connection there between those two things. Now, when I present theories like this, I'm not somebody who's trying to, oh, here's my conspiracy, please jump on and believe this. No. I'm not looking for notoriety as a conspiracy theorist of some sort, because there are plenty of people who are far more knowledgeable that could probably come up with better theories than me. I'm just saying, I read this thing in the book, and this is an interesting thing to think about. It's in the context of this book, it's an interesting thing to think about. This thing that we think of as a wild conspiracy that's ridiculous. And then all of a sudden I'm reading this book, and here's this piece. And now all of a sudden I'm looking over here and I'm going, is that possible? on some, even some small scale? Is that possible? And something else I should point out here too, the police chief was rumored, and I think it was more than just a police chief, was rumored to have been seen by people at these supposed sex parties. And this police chief could not seem to solve the List case, and it wasn't until he was gone that they actually started making progress on these cases. Weird. Well, here's the other thing about him. He had some kind of trouble before this, where he had like this bag, this duffel bag full of sex toys in his car. And then recently he was arrested for, I think it was for soliciting sex. And these crazy conspiracies start to seem a little less crazy in the context of these things. Now, is it possible for it to be this huge international cabal? I don't know. That's beyond the reach of what we're talking about here. But it does seem quite possible that there's something strange going on Long Island. And I haven't even gone into like the crazier, more outlandish theories about Long Island or Montauk in particular. Like the Montauk monster. They found this, what people thought was a mutated monster that washed up on the beach. I've seen the pictures. I'm pretty sure it's a partially decomposed raccoon. But I'm looking at a photograph. What do I know? There's also, this one's a little hazy for me, but there's a documentary called, I think it was called Project Montauk or Montauk Project, or maybe it was a series and they did an episode on this, but supposedly there was some testing facility up on Montauk where they were, if I remember correctly, they were either kidnapping or bringing in like young boys who were on the street and training them to become super soldiers. Like I said, this is where you start to go out there. But the fact that so many things seem to come up about Long Island, and when you look at Long Island in comparison to even just the rest of New York, Long Island is pretty innocuous. It's where rich people go for the summer. You've heard of people going to the Hamptons. That's Long Island. So for there to be, by the way, once you get outside of the city, you know, the five boroughs of New York City, some of which is on Long Island, once you get outside of that, it just becomes either beaches or residential areas, you know, just homes and housing and stuff like that. It's not city up Long Island. So for these things to be all associated with this place, it just seems super strange. I mean, Joel Rifkin, Robert Schumann, Richard Angelo, John Bitroff, Alan Gormley, Rex Huerman, and then possibly, maybe Bitroff is the Manorville butcher. Maybe there's somebody else. Maybe Rex Huerman is the Long Island serial killer and guilty of all 10, and maybe he's not. Even if you just take those into account, you have to wonder what's going on. What is it about Long Island? And I read a lot of true crime, and I can't think of another place where there were this many active killers at the same time. Now, that's excluding the possibility that the Atlanta child killers, that case was not just one person, that it was actually multiple people, which is one of the theories that may compete here. The only other thing I could think of was Los Angeles. But even in Los Angeles, things were spread out more. They weren't all condensed in like one decade. It's just very, very strange. And now you throw all these other theories in there, and the theories by themselves sound strange, but when you put them in the context of this many active serial killers at one time, it's weird. It's just something to think about, something to spin around in your head. It's really all, when I want to talk about stuff from books, that's really all I want to do is just give you things to spin around in your head. I'm not interested, as I said before, I'm not interested in telling you how to think, or sorry, not interested in telling you what to think. I'm interested in talking about how to think. How can we look at these things? Because I think if we look at this objectively, we can't immediately jump to the fact that there's a cabal. We can't immediately jump to the fact that there's a conspiracy. We can't even immediately jump to the fact that John Bitroff is the Manorville Butcher, or that Rex Huerman killed all 10 people. We can't even jump to the conclusion that Rex Huerman killed the three women that he's on trial for until we see the evidence, until he goes to trial. Then we can't. That's the way this country works. And we also can't, this is where we get caught up, because yeah, those like the Montauk monster and those things, we can't immediately jump to the conclusion that those are true. Like I said, I'm pretty sure the Montauk monster was a decomposed raccoon from what I saw. But because we know we can't jump to those conclusions, sometimes what that means is people just all of a sudden jump to the conclusion that that means that the opposite is what we should believe. That there was nothing going on, that it's not strange that there were this many killers at one time. That one, because the moment you start to say that, people think that you're saying that is true. And all I'm saying is, if you really look at this objectively, you can't make a decision one way or the other because there's not enough evidence. It's like if I told you 2 + 2 + X, what is that? What is it? What's 2 + 2 + X? I don't know. It's at least 4, but I don't know what X is. X could be 0. X could be 20. But until I know what X is, I can't tell you what that adds up to. And that's the same thing here. When we look at crimes, when we look at possible strange, possible conspiracies, cults, things like that, we can pick up pieces and we can say, it sure looks like this. But at a certain point, I think we get emotional and we get, to be honest, we get, we almost eroticize the mystery. We eroticize it and we want it to be true, so then it becomes true. We don't know either way. The people who automatically, it's just like with UFOs. Now, UFOs do exist because UFO means unidentified flying object. It means I saw something in the sky, I don't know what it is. We know that's true because people see things in the sky and they go, what is that? Okay. What they are is what we don't know. And there are people who are staunchly in the camp that they're nothing. And people are staunchly in the camp that they are extraterrestrials, and people who are staunchly in other camps. But none of them have enough evidence to make that final decision. We don't know. And it doesn't mean that we can't think about these things at the same time. And we have to be able to have these open discourses. We have to be able to talk about these things. Why wouldn't we? If there's a 4% possibility that there are people from another planet flying above our heads, we should be talking about that, even if it's 4% possibility. If there's a possibility that something strange is going on Long Island, we should be able to talk about that without people jumping down each other's throats, assuming you know what other people believe, because there's not enough evidence. But it's something we can talk about, something we can discuss. These are important things just for the way we use our brain. This is the world. These are things that are out in the world. These ideas are out in the world, and these details that I've given you, these are things out in the world. Why wouldn't we discuss them? Why are they difficult? Why are they things we avoid? Why are things we automatically jump to one camp or the other? Why can't we learn to live in this messy gray? Because guess what? Most of life is messy gray. Almost all of our life is an assumption. You know this chair? You can't see it. I can. I'm sitting on it. You don't know I'm on a chair. If I told you I was sitting on a stool, you'd have to believe me because you can't see this chair. You don't have enough evidence. Now, you probably assumed I'm sitting in a chair because that's what people usually sit at when they sit at a desk. What if I'm sitting on a rock? You don't know. And that's my point. I'm not saying we should sit around and talk about what I'm sitting on, but I'm saying most of our reality, most of our life, most of everything we live on is assumption. And we get too passionate with our assumptions to where we start to use words like right. I'm right. Are you? Are you? Because I can tell you that most things, I mean, you must have gone through this at least in regards to politics in the last 5-6 years, that you get in an argument with somebody and they ask you enough questions. At a certain point, you realize you can no longer answer the question because you don't have all the information. None of us do. That's why I think these things are interesting. That's why I think difficult and strange and sometimes outlandish ideas are important to talk about, why they're nourishing to talk about for the brain. Because they're not that different from what we accept as reality. And I think sometimes talking about something like this, which could be, I mean, even if we were talking about Let's say we were talking about the super soldier program, something that sounds completely outlandish. Even if we were talking about that, I think sometimes we're interested in talking about those things more because they seem a little more detached from our accepted reality. And that things like this, the idea that there could be rich and powerful people having a sex cult in Long Island, is a little too close to reality for comfort. The fact that that's a possibility is a little too uncomfortable. And it hasn't passed by me that I'm recording this episode on the day that the Epstein client list is going to be released. Because that's as close to a sex orgy cult, if you want, of rich and powerful people than we've ever seen. I don't know all the details on that either, but you have to start to wonder. And I'm not sure that I'm ready to go on vacation on Long Island. Are you?